My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is a military medical historian. Her passion for history has led her to become a trusted advisor to the Casivac Club. Her knowledge and understanding of blast injury is now changing the way children receive treatment around the world. Episode 25, Emily Mayhew. This is Declassified. I've got in front of me London, fashion, and the 80s. Why has that got any link to why you're in this studio today?
It's a very good question. I have a colleague who introduces me as this is Emily, my colleague. She's a historian. It's complicated, and it really is complicated. This is my second career. I came to London when I was just about 18, and I went into fashion, and that was last century. And I worked there for 20 years, and then left and went to university. So I'm a late. I don't know if I'm a late bloomer, but I was certainly a mature student. Mm. And I consider the two parts of my life to be very linked, because if you work, as I did in fashion retail, what you know how to do is deliver on commitment at 9 o'clock every morning. You've got to open the shop and you've got to sell things to customers and you've got to make sure your staff have got what they needed. And you've got to deliver solutions quickly and easily and practically. And then I went to university, studied history, became very involved in how you make history useful in everyday life. And so now I sit in a science department, so it's even more complicated, fashion, history, science. Mm. And I work on trying to find the best solutions, particularly for our wounded veteran community, really quickly and practically.
Why did you initially go to history? Why did you initially study history?
I always liked history, and I was never mathsy. I knew it wasn't going to be something where I relied on having to do numbers. But otherwise, I might have done engineering, and also I was 40, so it was late to do to get a career started in anything else that was going to require technical mathematical skill. My two favourite subjects at school were English and history. But I always really, really liked history. The book I most remember having on my shelf at home was R.J. Unstead's Great Men and Women of British History. And when I thought back to the kind of book I'd liked to write, that was really it. Mm. And it was a good course. I could do it. I did the Open University, and I could do, you could switch periods and centuries as every year that went on, so you could get a lot down you in 3.5 years. And I ended up doing history of science, and that was really where it came from. I'd never really thought about history as having specific subjects to focus on.
Was that your BA? Or was that
was my BA.
So that the BA was that, then you went, did you go straight on to your MA?
I went straight on to an MSc, yeah. So my final year on my history BA was the history of science, technology and medicine, and how the history of the decisions that we make about scientific discoveries and medical practice and research, how that's often historically determined, but also how most of the people making those decisions aren't thinking about the history. So I didn't at the time see a gap for me, but actually that was what I was doing. Mm. So I went straight and did a history of science MSc. And from there, you have to do a thesis right at the end. And I chose a subject I knew about. It was a history I knew about because it was part of my family. And I realised that a lot of people knew a little bit about it, but they didn't know enough, and it was very important. And that was the history of the Guinea Pig Club. And the Guinea Pig Club was a club started by patients in the Second World War who'd been really badly burned as part of being in the RAF, either because their aircraft had crashed on takeoff or landing, or because they'd exploded in midair in the Battle of Britain, or one of the bombers out on the strategic bombing campaign. And they'd had really bad burns injuries that no one had expected them to survive. Before 1939, they'd have died in burns wards, or in fact, not even in burns wards. And my grandmother was a nurse at the hospital. So it's a story we grew up knowing. And I knew it was really important. I wasn't quite sure how, but I knew that I had to go away and do as much research as possible to see what was in there. So I did my master's thesis to start with, and that went straight into a PhD.
Well, elaborate on it's fascinating. This is with the guinea pig club. Could you go into it a little bit more? Really get into what it was
Absolutely.
About and go through the history of. We could be here for literally hours, days.
It's a really truly fascinating story, and it tends to get lumped into the category of a heartwarming tale of human endurance. You know, you get this sort of Battle of Britain, stiff upper lip. In the case of the Guinea Pig Club, no upper lip was mostly the case. But there's a really important medical point to make, first of all, and that is that there was a change in the way that we treated really severely wounded casualties right at the end of the 1930s, and we didn't really know that we'd made a lot of progress because we didn't get a lot of severely wounded people outside wartime. But the way we treated people when they had shock, when they'd had their bad trauma, and when they got the primary and secondary shock, which is the body really reacting to this tremendous insult, usually that would kill you. On its own.
Physical trauma.
And then the body is often reacting or overreacting to the damage that's been done. And in the case of burns injury, the body rushes fluid to the area where the burn is. So when you get a burn, you get a blister. And that, in essence, is what happens with all burns injury. The body rushes fluid to the area because it knows that it's been burned. And if you have a really bad burn injury, the body rushes fluid to the area. But if it's over a large amount of your body, then the body's going to become really dehydrated really quickly. And not just dehydrated, it's going to damage your organs, your heart, and your brain. And if you can't get fluids into people quickly to replace those that are going out at the wound, then the patient will die. And that was really what happened to people who had bad burns injury before 1936, 1937. But during that time, hospitals became a bit more like hospitals we know today. They didn't have A&E departments, but they had departments that dealt with people that had got sudden bad injuries. And what they started to do at that point was give you the fluids. It was saline then. It wasn't the complex of things that we have now. But they did the most important thing of all, which was put back the liquids that were being lost at the wound site. We didn't really know what a huge turning point this was until we went to war, and we started to get young men being very badly burned, mostly not so much injured, but very badly burned in their bodies, and most importantly in their faces and their hands. And they were brought back and they were given a saline treatment, they were given fluid replacement therapy, and then they didn't die. And medical progress is made by unexpected survivors. What happens to people who we would have expected to die, who don't die? Because we haven't expected that we're going to need to provide a long course of care for them. We've planned for the stuff we know we can, for the people we know we can survive, but we haven't planned for the people who are supposed to die. So in the Battle of Britain, there were 55 patients who were burned in Spitfires or Hurricanes, some of whom had landed in the sea and had been rescued from the sea, and being in salt water helped their wounds tremendously, kept them clean. So even if they were in the ocean for they weren't in the ocean, they were generally in the English Channel. For 3 or 4 days, they would come out again, not dead. They would be treated with intravenous...
3 or 4 days?
3 or 4 days, absolutely, absolutely. There is a legendary story of one member of the Guinea Pig Club, who is, I think, in Bomber Command, who was in a dinghy for 3 or 4 days, and was forced to eat a seagull to stay alive. He caught a seagull and he drank the blood, because, of course, everybody knows you can't drink salt water. And he drank the blood of the seagull and he ate what he could of the seagull. And for the remainder of, when he was finally rescued, for the remainder of his time in hospital, there was a lot of, you can imagine, if you'd ever had to eat it, if you were in the military and someone said, yeah, I had to eat a seagull, they would never be allowed to forget that for the rest of their life. But yeah, people survived in the water. And because anyone who's seen a Battle of Britain film, you'll know you had those big ops rooms with people pushing models around and people keeping lists of who was in and who was back and who was missing. So nobody went missing without anybody noticing. They went out, the Coast Guard went out and looked for people. So they would hopefully be found if they were still floating in the ocean. But they came back, or they crash landed on runways. They survived. And then 2 or 3 weeks after their injury, you have a young 25-year-old man who's been expensively trained to fly one of Britain's new fighters. And no provision for someone whose fingers and hands are missing, and where clearly their burns injury is getting worse, not better. What had happened was the RAF had appointed a consultant plastic surgeon. They did it because plastics existed and they thought it might come in handy. They had no idea if it was, they didn't know what they were going to use him for. They thought they must, they might like just bolt him on with other surgeons to do general surgical work during the war. But they had a surgeon and they had a hospital at East Grinstead down in Sussex, where I grew up, near where I grew up. These things all come together. Mm. And his name was Archibald McIndoe, and he was a New Zealander originally. He was given this hospital and went down to inspect it, and very soon after, in the end of 1939, just after war had broken out, got really his first patient, who was a young pilot who'd been injured in training, whose hands had been very badly damaged, whose face had been very badly damaged. But the worst part of it was his eyelids had been very badly damaged. He was supposed to be wearing goggles, but it was warm weather. If you're flying a Spitfire and you're sweating, if your goggles are making your eyes sweat, you can't see. So a lot of pilots took off the things that were supposed to protect them, their goggles and their gloves, and therefore that's where they got burned. Mm. And he'd lost his eyelids and wasn't able to close them, and it was quite obvious that the damage that had been done to his eyelids was affecting his sight. And if he couldn't mend his eyelids, that not only would this young boy be burned, he would also be blind. And so he was wheeled into the operating theatre, and McIndoe was asked about this later, and he said, how did you know how to repair a set of eyelids? Because no one had ever survived these kind of burns before. And he said, well, I looked down at the patient and God came down my right arm. Mm. And I don't think it was a religious moment, but what I think he meant was he had really good surgical instincts. Plus this very strong sense that if he didn't try and repair eyelids, that you're looking at someone not only very badly injured, but blinded and not by the original injury. So there are 55 people who need serious burns repair in the Battle of Britain. And then the bombing campaign starts, the strategic bombing campaign. And they know that this is going to be where most of the patients come from. And indeed, they do. For the remainder of the Second World War, there'll be 5,000 serious burns cases coming out of the RAF, whether it's Coastal Command, Fighter Command, Bomber Command. And 700 of them are unexpected survivors. These are people suffering 700. Burns. 700. So they would have been expected to die. They would have been put in a part of the hospital where they couldn't infect the other patients and they would have been expected to die, except they hadn't died. And lots of things were coming together. They started to realise that we had enough Spitfires and Hurricanes and Lancasters and Wellingtons, but what we really needed was experienced pilots. So it wasn't just that you needed to treat these people. It was that if at all possible, they could go back to flying. Because that was really what was necessary. I mean, I think this remains the case in the army today. You can have all the tech you want, but what you really want is experienced people using it and experienced people training other people in how to use it. And it was the same back in the Second World War. So by 1941, there are 20 or 30 patients in the hospital during 1941. They're a mixture of Fighter Command and Bomber Command, I think a couple of Coastal Command. And they've been in the hospital a while, getting regular skin grafts. So skin grafts on their faces, having their eyelids repaired, having their noses, their top lips repaired, having ears built for them, because the surgeon realises that if you're going to wear glasses, you need ears. If you lose your ears in a burns injury, you might think, well, I can still hear, so I won't worry about that. But if you think about wearing sunglasses or in later life having to wear glasses, you're going to need a little nub of ear that you can put your glasses on. And he's repairing their hands. The rest of them is a little easier for a plastic surgeon. The flaps that you have on your body is a little easier. But he's repairing the really difficult bits, not just the bits that are functional, so how you breathe, how you speak, how you pick things up, but also how you communicate emotion, how you communicate to other people, and how you are received in society. By 1941, they've realised that repairing somebody's burnt face, really complicated, lots more going on than just the technical repair. And the patients, it's quite remarkable, the patients have a sense that they're something new, that they're a new group and I keep coming back to this phrase, unexpected survivors, but it's so important. They realise this, and they realise that they're not just the patients to the senior medics, but they're both on a journey of discovery together. So it's a very equal process. The surgeons come and talk to them, and they don't say, I'll be doing this and you'll be doing this. They say, I'm hoping to do this. I want to talk to you about it because I haven't done this before. No one has done this before. We need to find out what's going to work the best. So the patients go to each other's operations. They go, there's a balcony built over the operating theatre. And when you look at the pictures from the time, you see surgeons in white scrubs. They were white scrubs then. And you see patients in RAF uniform who are clearly mid-surgical repair. And they're both watching what's being done because no one's ever seen it before. And you need both people's points of view, the patient and the medic who'll do the future repair. But the patients decide that beyond that, what they need is a group that's just for them. They want to found a group that only they can belong to, so they can support each other in the ways that only they understand that support should be given and received.
Socially.
So socially. But while they're in the hospital, you become a member when you come to the hospital. It's one of the criteria of membership. So they get this, they get a bottle of sherry on the ration, and they all pour out a little glass of it really can't have been very good sherry. And they raise a toast to starting a club for patients. There were two criteria. You had to be in the RAF. You had to be injured in service in the RAF during the Second World War. It was extended to 1947 to sort of cover everybody who were bringing planes back. But really only that war and only that service. And you had to have a burns injury. And then you could be in the club. And it took them a couple of months, but they worked out, because they were guinea pigs, we used the term then, they were really guinea pigs for all these new surgical procedures. They called themselves the Guinea Pig Club. So they were a club for unexpected survivors of burns injury from the RAF and from the Second World War. And they really changed everything.
And this was the hospital your grandmother was at?
That was the connection that I had. So my grandmother worked at the hospital as a nurse, and she was a little bit older than the average nurse. She'd been born in the 19th century. She'd been a teenager in the First World War. And so she knew what war looked like. And it comes back to this idea that when you're repairing someone's face, you're not just repairing it functionally. You're repairing, trying to get the best possible outcome for them when they go out into the wider public. So early on in the war, there were some issues at the hospital where people had joined the fighter command. They were those dashing pilots of Spitfires and Hurricanes. They got married very quickly. They bought a red sports car and they got married very quickly because they didn't know if they were going to come back. And of course, they did. They unexpectedly survived. And there were cases reasonably frequently where their fiancé or their new wife would come down and say, I don't recognise this person. This is not the man I married. And you can't prove it is because they probably couldn't because there were no fingerprints. And they would walk away. And what McIndoe realised was that there was a better way to handle that you didn't just take people in and say, here is the husband you've known really not for very long and he's wrapped in bandages now. So he asked my grandmother, who he knew, to come in to take charge of that process of how the wives and the families and later on there would be children would be taken in to meet the patient who was the same man inside but who looked very differently on the outside. And this is absolutely fundamental now. If you go onto a burns ward, you manage that process whereby people find acceptance amongst their family and amongst their community. Even really simple things like if you have a really bad facial injury, they're very careful about when you first see it. So if you go on a burns ward, there are no reflective surfaces. They're very careful about when you go to the bathroom in case there's a mirror in there. And back in the day of this hospital where my grandmother was, they had to be careful even about the tea urns. Because if you've been woken up and you've been told you've got a facial injury, the first thing that you want to do is you want to see it. And you're not ready at that point to see it. That whole process has to be really carefully managed. So my grandmother was one of the people that was brought in to manage that process. She'd been through the First World War. She lost almost all her friends. She'd seen the amount of, particularly where they grew up in the southeast of England, there were tens of thousands of men who had amputations and very serious injuries, and she could handle it. The surgeon wanted somebody there who was a bit grown up and could handle it. The difficult conversation with the fiancé or the mum or the child and the young man who had been handsome and wasn't anymore. So that was what she did there.
Almost like the counselling of.
It wasn't called counselling, and it wasn't called, absolutely, now we would. Now you get trained for it. You have a structure. These are really good instincts, and they have, and it has a medical basis. If you don't do this properly, then the repairs don't work as well. We don't.
Oh, physically?
Physically, exactly.
So the psychological effects impact the physical
100%,
effect?
100%. And, you know, you...
On a cellular kind of...
And we don't know what the process is, but it's you can, I always think you can never really separate the psychological and the physiological and the physical. We're all one organism. And if you're experiencing a great deal of stress, psychologically or physically, that's going to impact the rest of the way we are as human beings. So if you can get somebody who's able to deal with the challenge of a really serious burns injury, if they understand everything that's happening to them, and you can communicate them to their family, so that process can be as productive as possible, then they're going to heal more quickly, and they're going to be able to envisage returning to work and leading a life beyond the injury. And I think we'd probably call that post-traumatic growth now. Certainly there's very strong elements of that. But the surgeon sensed, there wasn't any data, that if he didn't get that part of it right, that his job as a surgeon was going to be much more difficult. So he secures that really quickly. And he does it by the end of 1941, so that when they start the really big bombing campaigns, when you'll get hundreds of people coming in during a year, which is more than a burn surgeon will see in a lifetime here. When you get hundreds of, they really have the best system in place.
Actually, for a minute, I forgot we were recording. Okay. I was just listening to you.
Okay, sorry.
The guinea pig club was set up, and did they think it was just going to be just for that moment in time during the war? Was there a long term vision towards it? What was the feeling with the men?
It was just for that moment in the war. I think it was, again, they were sensing this process that you'd come from a service with a very strong squadron ethos. You know, you joined the RAF, you were in your squadron, you were in your fighter command. You felt very strongly a member of that. And that was really supportive. So that what they wanted to do was add to that. It wasn't that people weren't going to go back because they were, but they wanted people to not feel alone when they did. I don't think they were thinking about what happened at the end of the war, primarily because we didn't know there was going to be an end of the war. We didn't really have much of a sense of that until, I think, after D-Day. We talk about the end of the beginning of the troops in North Africa, but really once we'd gone over in July 1944, that was when people had a sense that the war might be at an end. But before then, we could easily have been at war forever.
So it was all about just treating your mates?
It was treating your mates.
It was looking building... after your mates.
Exactly. And I think they probably... we've got some paperwork, you know, they never say, well, let's form a club and let's invite a historian along and she can observe. Well, actually, we'll come to that later. But they didn't then. But I think they sensed that a patient that was talking to the other patients in the ward, that was making jokes about people eating seagulls, that was... you know, saying, well, you know, I'm in a bit of pain. My mum's coming today. I don't really know how I'm going to talk to her. A patient that was able to feel that he was part of something in the ward was a patient that was going to do better.
And he was speaking to people who was going through the same
exactly the same thing.
And I
think they'd understood. Already sensed that value. When you knew you had that injury and that whatever came next, there was always going to be a certain amount of explaining what had happened to you to the world beyond the ward. Knowing that you had this ward, that you had these, your comrades, your mates, where you never, ever, ever had to explain what had happened to you because the same thing had happened to them or something very similar, so they completely understood. And I think being in that space where you don't have to say, the reason that my hands look like this is because everybody's hands look like that. That is something, it's very valuable, but it's more than that. It's absolutely invaluable. And they sensed that and they created the club so they could really institutionalize that in something tangible.
And how many members was the
The initial group of members, I think, were about 30. And by the end of 1947, so when all the aircraft had been brought back from all the places that we'd been fighting in across the globe, and that, so that was really the cut-off point for the Guinea Pig Club, there were 649 members.
Oh, right. And what then was the vision of the club? Still to be social, but was it...
Well, it was very interesting because it was to be social, but they always had this really strong sense, it was half social, half medical, that they were on the cutting edge, that they were the people that had transformed plastic surgery. By then they knew that plastic surgery, that the plastic surgeons in Britain were the best in the world, that everyone came to them to learn, and that the and that they were as equally important part of that. Of that process. So they wanted to make sure that they kept up to speed with the latest developments that could relate to them, as well as getting together socially. And there was a third element that I didn't really understand until recently, and that was that we always tend to read history backwards. We look at, if you look at pictures of the Guinea Pig Club in 1947, you think, well, those are grafts. Those are skin grafts on the face. We know how to do those now. We know that they're fine. But back in 1947, they didn't know if grafts stayed on forever. Mm. They had no idea. There might come a point where they fell off and you had to do a new one.
Was that the first time?
That was really the first time anybody'd have them that young.
Young and en masse as well.
That young. They'd been doing, and particularly on the face and hands. So part of the body that people are moving all the time, particularly on your hands, where you bump, if you think about how often you bump your hands. It is a graft that gets bumped all the time, where and a face that has to be washed all the time, that gets exposed to the sun. Is that going to be a good graft? And they had been it. There'd been an outbreak of infection on the ward in 1944, where some grafts had fallen off. So that was the very worst case scenario. Are these grafts going to survive? And we need to monitor them medically. And then we need to think about what might happen if they don't. And then the other thing that there was, and again, this is a significant difference between now and then, they thought you could do as few operations, surgical operations, as possible, because they thought anaesthetics were probably bad for you. The chemicals were quite strong, and they didn't know if you had a lot of anaesthetics, if that would be generally bad for you overall, particularly putting a tube down someone's throat, which did the breathing for them while they were being operated on. So they tended to only do one surgical operation a month, possibly two, but that was all. And they were concerned if this was going to have a long-term effect on people's respiratory tracts and on their breathing. So the patients wanted to get together. They wanted to make sure they were up to speed with the latest medical happenings. And the doctors and surgeons who treated them wanted to keep an eye on the treatment that they'd given them. So they decided that once a year they'd spend the weekend together, that they'd come back to the hospital and they'd have a dinner in the evening, which would just be for members of the club. But they'd have spent the day before with their doctors, understanding what was happening to them. But on both sides, it was both the patients and the doctors understanding what was happening to them. And of course, what was happening to them was they weren't being substantially damaged by having a lot of anaesthetics. And their grafts never fell off. But they did discover things like their hands, if you'd had your hands repaired, that if it got bashed, you might need a little extra graft on that, on a wound that wouldn't heal.
To protect
a very
the
small one. But it was repair, exactly. Yeah, so it was very much repair. But again, learning, if you've never had someone who's had their eyelids replaced, nobody knows what that looks like. It's the unexpected survivor. Nobody knows what that looks like 10 years after. What we learned was that eyelids shrank. You had to give slightly more tissue than was needed. Not too much, not too little, just enough. And then you had to keep an eye on it for 10 years to see that they weren't tightening up, to see if there was going to be a little extra work needed or a few stitches in the corner of the eye. So everybody was learning. So they learned on the Saturday, and on the evening they went into a dinner. That was 100% social. But
how long did that? Sorry, go on. No, go on.
It was 100% social, and it was, they would go into the dinner, and then the doors would close, and there wouldn't be a single person in that room, apart from occasionally people bringing in food, who didn't understand exactly what was going on. It was one night a year where they didn't have to explain themselves. Mm. And that's the thing that they always talked about, and they went quiet, and they said, one night a year where you don't have to explain yourself, it's enough.
I was going to ask, how long did that all go on for then?
And that went on, they had the last formal dinner, I think, in the early 2000s. And by then they were all, this is a very long time, this went on, the guinea pig officially went on until 2017. And then it became, there are still some, the club went on until 2017, there are still some members, but they don't really get together now because travel is difficult and they're elderly. Mm. But again, nobody expected anybody with severe burns injury to survive into their 90s. I remember going to the very last guinea pig club dinner, and I was allowed to go because I'd written a book. I didn't stay for the whole thing, but I went in, and there was a point at which I was sitting at the table, and I was a tiny bit bored because everybody was talking about the golf club and they were talking about problems with their car or their grandchildren, and then they went off and had a sing song, and I was thinking, oh God, this is, you know, these are just normal everyday conversations, and I've come a long way to hear these. And then I thought, no, that's the real victory. I don't want them to be still sitting here 70 years later. Mm. Talking about flying a Spitfire. I want them to be talking about the problem they're having with their new Ford Fiesta, you know, with the fact that the golf club, they have to get a golf cart now because they don't want to walk so much anymore. Mm. Boring and normal is the victory. You're not going for exemplary medal winning necessarily. When I see people who've suffered a really severe injury and they've gone back into what is quite a normal, boring life, I always think, that's what we're aiming for. That's what the Guinea Pig Club taught me. Live till you're 90 and be boring and normal, because that's how you really win.
Mm. And what, over the course of that, 70 years, what was, did we see any notable advances in plastic surgery? I suppose a lot of that you're talking about is plastic surgery.
Absolutely. It's plastic surgery. We did. Firstly, we saw plastic surgery really be accepted as something that was a discipline on its own. Before the Second World War, it existed, and it was used occasionally, but it wasn't used very much on burns wards because people tended to die. So you had people with not very serious wounds, didn't necessarily need a graft. It was used to treat children with congenital deformities. And we also started seeing the beginnings of cosmetic surgery, that you get that the roots of cosmetic surgery come from the cinema, when people see their faces up really big and they want their faces lifted. So there's something like what we understand as plastic surgery today, but nothing, but no institutionalisation, no real establishment. There aren't special courses. There aren't, you know, academic journals. There aren't special schools where you go and learn it. Plastic surgery, as a result of the Guinea Pig Club, is established as a discipline in its own right. Mm. And for the next 20 or 30 years, every single plastic surgeon in what was the British Empire during the war and the Commonwealth after the war comes and trains at East Grinstead. So plastic surgery is established, and plastic surgery, as done by plastic surgeons, an entire generation of them is created. And when you see a plastic surgeon today, you're never any more than two generational steps away from the Guinea Pig Club in East Grinstead, because the chances are that the surgeon that you see today was trained by someone who was trained by McIndoe and may have worked on members of the Guinea Pig Club. And the hospital is still there, and it's still one of the most significant places where you can go and train to do burns treatment, plastic surgery, maxillofacial surgery, which is repairing the bones of the face. And it's there, and it's a centre of excellence because it was established during the Second World War.
This is definitely the least I've ever spoken the first.
Okay. Well,
no, it's perfect.
Well, it's
great.
It's so important. What, you know, you go back there and everything we need to know now, it's sitting there. And I'm the historian. I'm not a plastic surgeon telling you this. I speak olden days. Yeah. So if you've ever got, you know, if there are questions about this, ask a historian.
This is a perfect conversation to have, and with regards to the gentlemen, the pilots and navigators that were affected, did they feel like there was real purpose in what they were doing?
They absolutely did. And they went in and talked, after the war was over, they went in and they talked to children who came into burns units. They had a strong relationship with the hospital. There was really a lot. I think that the last of them had their last operation in 1947, so where they were fully repaired. Then there were sort of maintenance repairs, but their last operation was done in 1947. But that was a lot. If you were burned in 1941 or 1942, that was a long time being repaired. You know, they would get their grafts, then they would go back into the RAF. And very early on, one of the most remarkable things to me is that the RAF and the country recognises that these are not people who should be hidden away. Everywhere else, they're hidden away, but not in the UK. And it's something we should be really proud of. People go back mid-repair. They fly Spitfires and Hurricanes. They fly Lancasters and Wellingtons and Halifaxes, or they're their navigator or their bomb aimer. They go back and they do the job that they were trained to do because they can. And the public and the RAF learn to read the injury. They learn to look at someone who's got an RAF uniform and a burn and know exactly what it means. So that's part of the responsibility that they feel they have to communicate that. Till 1944, the vast majority of the British Army is in Britain, waiting to go to Europe. There are some in North Africa, but a million of them are sitting in Britain waiting to go to Europe. The people who are fighting the war every day are the RAF. And some of them are showing the marks of it, are showing the sacrifice that they've made. So that's really important. But they also take on this responsibility for plastic surgery. They become ambassadors for plastic surgery, not just showing how the lives that they're now leading with their plastic surgery repairs can be as fulfilling as a life of the life that they would have had. But also they go and talk to people who are suffering from burns, and they explain to them, they act as role models. So in the Falkland Islands, when we had some really bad, probably the most significant burns cohort since the Second World War, they were down in the burns units, in the Army and Navy burns units. And Simon Weston was asked to become an honorary guinea pig club. And he valued his relationship with the Guinea Pig Club as much as they valued their relationship with him.
Let's jump it then. Let's move. There was loads of stuff I was going to speak to you about, and that'll wait for another time. And you're now the historical advisor to the Kazivac Club.
The Kazivac Club, exactly.
Now, this was set up
in 2017.
Just go.
Can I just go?
Just
is that
go.
Okay? So it's a long, I guess everybody's realised by now that once I start, I don't really stop. But in 2017, I was working at Imperial College, and I'd already started to work with the veterans cohort that we had from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I know Dave Henson, who you've had on this show before, is a colleague of mine at Imperial. He's doing work on building better prosthetics, more comfortable prosthetics. So not just prosthetics that can do sports and all sorts of other cool things, but that are comfortable to wear every day, because it is the boring, normal stuff that's the important stuff. If we can take care of that, then we can do anything else. And I was talking to him about long-term outcomes and how we best monitor those and how we can make sure that 10, 20 years after people have been injured with complex casualty, unexpected survivors, what's the best model for making sure that people's recovery is sustained? What's the best way to see... We know all about survival, but what about life beyond survival and the long life beyond survival? And we were just chatting away over a brew, as we do. And I said, well, there is an organisation that was started after the Second World War for unexpected survivors. And it's still going. It was just still going. They're all in their 90s now. But you know, they met once a year, and it had this incredible effect on their recovery. And they were called the Guinea Pig Club. And I had the same conversation I had with you.
And I know said, more about them than anyone in the world.
And I know more about them than anyone in the world. That's, you know, it's niche, but it's my niche. And I'm not, you know, I'm very proud of it. And Dave, and I started to tell him the story, and he asked a few questions, and then he just went quiet for a bit. And he said, well, let's have a new guinea pig club then. And I said, yeah, I think that's a very good idea. And he went away and he talked to David Wiseman, who I know you've also had on the show, on the podcast.
Yeah.
And they came up with the idea of creating a group that was half medical and half social, for the unexpected survivors of weapons trauma, whether that was physical or psychological, from Iraq and Afghanistan. And when we looked at the numbers, there were about 700. Well, there were 649 guinea pigs.
Of people that would have been dead.
Exactly. The people that, if you'd given me the medical journals before a certain point on TELIC, and also on Herrick, and you'd said, this is what this person has got, I would say, well, they're not going to make it. They're going to set them aside. They're not going to make it. And yet they did. So we had about 700 unexpected survivors from TELIC and Herrick, from weapon wounding. People who were generally Kazovac'd back, so particularly on Herrick. They were brought in on the Chinooks and they were treated on the Chinooks. And normally by the time the Chinooks bumped down at Field Hospital Camp Bastion, their lives were saved. So they didn't, I remember having a going in and this conversation very quickly becoming something purposeful. And them asking questions and my saying, I'm not going to guess at these. I'm not going to give you my best guess. I'm going to tell you what they did in 1946 and then you can see if that's relevant. And we got to the end of the, and I remember talking to David Wiseman and he had a big bit of paper and a marker. Which is how he does his business. Oh, that sounds terrible. Sorry. Which is how he does business. And he put this up on a board and he said, I'm not interested in the guinea pig, you know, this cohort study after 5 years. I'm interested after 10 years. And he drew a line and he went 10 years and then 25 years. He said, can you help me with that? And I said, I can tell you how it was 70 years afterwards. And he said, okay. And then he sat down and he said, we are going to need a new name, however, because the new guinea pig club is not really going to work for me. So they sat and they thought about what everybody had in common in this group of 700 unexpected survivors, and what they had in common was that they'd been Kazovac'd out of the place where they were wounded. So
and then medevaced as well.
And
is
then
that
medevaced.
Right? Yeah.
But that made it a very long name. If it's going to be Kazovac Medevac, it's a very long name.
So that's the criteria.
That's the criteria. Yeah. You had to be Kazakh or very close to, but you had to be Kazovac or medevac. And so what they decided to call the club was the Kazovac Club.
Yeah.
And there are seven, the membership is growing. There are potentially only 700 members.
Yeah.
If they're going to make an exception, it'll have to go through the committee because that's what the Guinea Pig Club did. They had one or two people. They had some Royal Navy people. They let them in, but very few. And it had to go through the committee and it had to be agreed that the experience was the same. So when they're in that room once a year, they don't have to explain themselves. That's really the main rule. You don't want to have to explain yourself. And they set rules. And I think that was one of the things that I said to them as a historian was, I know that the reason the Guinea Pig Club worked is because they stuck to the rules pretty closely. Mm. That they didn't ever lose focus. This always had a military context. It didn't have any civilian members. It had a very specific wounding context. Mm. And it was from a very specific military period. If you make membership open-ended so that people are coming in from different parts of the world, from having been wounded in different ways, what you end up with is a lack of focus. And if you don't have focus, then you're not on the cutting edge anymore. You're not, you can't be as valuable to medicine as medicine can be to you.
We've said this before, and it comes from my vague understanding of the Kazovac Club when I've spoke to David
Wise,
Davids. And it's, same injury, same
place.
Same time, same bomb. Well, I said this before on this podcast, and same mindset,
same resilience, mindset.
same
absolutely.
Purpose,
amazing. But mostly that you don't have to explain that to anyone because you automatically know. You might have to ask what Herrick you were on, what Telic you were on, but as soon as you know what number that was, you don't have to explain anything else. The doors close, and you're in that space where you don't have to.
And
explain
it is closed. I said to one of the Davids, I said, oh, can we do a podcast at the Kazovac Club? Yeah. And he was like, no, speak to Emily.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm not in the Kazovac Club. I'm the special historical advisor. And if you've got any questions that I'm really, really happy to answer, but I go to the meetings. I go to, they have an annual general meeting and I sit in there for about an hour and then I go because then there's no one in the room who doesn't understand it. Well, Kath the cake lady, me, some of the people who've come to help with the setup, we leave. We close the doors and we leave because those guys, that's what they need. And again, I remember sitting in a meeting with Dave Henson and explaining this business of closing the doors and not having to explain yourself, not having to no matter how friendly and positive people are, if they don't understand, they'll never quite understand. And he turned to me, and there was a room full of people, and he turned to me and he said, I want that. And it will be enough. They're right. It's enough. And when I went to, the last Guinea Pig Club meeting, and I went to the first Kazovac Club meeting, and there was such power in the room. Mm. You felt that power. And I kind of don't need to ever go again because I know that they're coming from the same place. They've recognised the legacy. They've learned the lessons. And they're taking it forward. And actually, David Wiseman did a really clever thing. He got a baton made. beautiful silver baton. And at one end is the logo of the Guinea Pig Club. And at the other end is the logo of the Casavac Club. And the Guinea Pig Club was 1941 to 2017. And the Casavac Club is 2017 until the last member dies. Then the Casavac Club will be no more. And I think the arrangement they've come to is the last surviving Casavac Club member gets to spend all the money. That's written into the club rules. It was not a rule that I suggested, but it seemed like a very good idea.
That's why Wiseman's doing loads of yoga.
That's why Wiseman's really looking after himself. He's like, suddenly. I mean, I won't be around then, but, you know, suddenly people say, wow, somebody's got a really good robot-powered jetpack. I know who that is. I know where that money went. But there's no questions so far that have come up relating to the Casavac Club that weren't answered by the Guinea Pig Club during its lifetime.
Well, and what are we seeing then now? What are we? Are these guys being tested on? What's going on? So socially, that's one aspect.
Yep.
The advancement in medical science is absolutely the other.
Absolutely.
What is it tangible?
Is it time? We are starting to see that. So we're not very far, you know, 2012, I think 2014 is when the last person comes out of Afghanistan. It's really not that long ago. And we don't know what the unexpected survivors of Afghanistan are going to have in 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. So the first thing that we've got is a group of people where if people say, I suspect there might be a problem with your blood pressure. You might have problems with your liver and kidneys. There may be issues that we need to be keeping an eye on.
Arthritis.
All those long-term things that if you're not paying attention to in 10 years' time, you might not necessarily relate to the fact that people have been really seriously injured and haven't and are unexpected survivors. Have come back from as close to death as we really know how to get people back from. They're the people that prove the case that you can do that. You can go right up to death and snatch people out of his bony grip. But we don't know if there are long-term consequences of that. So the first thing that we have is we have a focused place where we can go to people and say, will you participate in this study? We know from the people who've experienced limb loss or really serious injuries that arthritis is already starting to happen, and that we need to focus on the way their prosthetics fit, the way that they control their weight, the kind of exercise that they do. We already know that. And we don't just know that from one person. We know that from everybody who's had a limb replaced from as a result of hericontelic, or at least if it's not everybody, it probably will be eventually. It's a good number of them. And if you can go to the scientist and say, you're going to do your science and we're going to tell you the problems that need solving. It's an equal relationship. This is a partnership. This is a joint enterprise in securing the long-term outcomes for unexpected survivors. So the first thing it does, it gives focus to the people who want to do that science. And as I say, I think primarily in relation to the wearing of prosthetics, the way prosthetics should be, the way that people should live their lives and move with prosthetics. We know from the Casavac Club, for instance, that people wear their prosthetics for 10, 12 hours a day. Well, there's no textbook that went up to 2014 that would have said that was possible. They would have said 4 to 6 and then you're in your wheelchair. Well, most people say to me, I've put my wheelchair in the attic now. Do you think that's okay? And it's, well, the Casavac Club experience tells us that it is. And if you can use them to go and see medics, to go to a gait lab, to check the way that you're walking, to see the effect that it's having on your bone, to be careful and monitor for arthritis, for osteoarthritis effect, yeah, I think it's fine.
Speaking and getting to know Dave Henson really well was the first time I've thought, because of the same age, why is he same age? Saihama, same age.
Yep.
And I thought, excuse my French, I thought, fuck, no, it's now is the time. These people are making the difference.
They're making the
it's
difference.
It's not someone else making the difference.
They're making the
I'm
difference.
I'm sat with Dave Henson.
Yep.
Who's doing a PhD,
exactly.
He's the one that's going to be making the difference.
Absolutely.
Why is his strategy? makes the difference.
Exactly. And it will be one of the things that's really interesting, because the Kazvat Club, it went so much faster than I thought it would. I thought I'd be having conversations with them about stuff in about 10 years' time. I thought, well, I'll see. The Guinea Pig Club, for instance, took a while to work out that it wanted to be, well, it took about 10 years to work out that it was going to go into burns units and talk to burn children. It was going to go to service personnel who were burned. It took them a while to know, to understand that they had value in that space. But right from the outset, the Kazvat Club wanted to be outward facing. So they wanted not just to be dealing with medics, but for them to bring the experience that they've got and the resilience they've got, the post-traumatic growth, the good days and the bad days, the lessons that they've learned, and more importantly, the lessons they're learning every day, and they get to compare notes all the time. Just the being able to compare notes, you're not doing this on your own.
Yeah.
They wanted to take that into other situations that weren't as directly linked to the military. They wanted to work with charities themselves, that they have a strong sense of what it is that they can bring in that space. So the very first relationship they had is with a relatively new charity called Scar Free, who's looking at the long-term effects of scarring, both physically to improve them, but also the psychological effects of scarring. And although the Guinea Pig Club primarily suffer from limb injury, they understand what it's like, excuse me, to live with a complex trauma. So they connected with Scar Free, and they now work with them whenever they need to, and give them guidance in how they're going to structure both the physical and the psychological repairs that this organisation is going to make. We've just started, it's like last week, that the Kazvat Club is going to partner up with Save the Children.
Well, let's go there then. Before we go
there,
because
I wanted to
link this, because I think it's relevant. The very much Guinea Pig Club.
Yeah.
Let's look after ourselves.
Yep.
Rightfully so.
Yep.
Then where can we help others?
Yeah.
Like children who have been
absolutely.
In burns. Kazvat Club links with the Endeavour Fund, who are now going into phase three. It's all about role models and impacting society.
Absolutely.
Kazvat Club in itself. Look after ourselves. Yep. Let's look after our mates, making sure that we categorize everything and make sure everything's
absolutely.
Going well for us. But where can we impact
exactly.
others? You're direct where now we've saved the children.
Yep.
Are you going to go into it more? But really focusing on trauma injury with kids who have been in conflict or elsewhere in the world. Can you first off, how did you first create the link between yourself and Save the Children, and what is the impact, if any, the Kazvat Club will have on your work through Save the Children?
Yeah. Well, I started working with Save the Children, and I'm going to think back, and again, it was 2017. It was a busy year. It was 2017. I did an event at the Science Museum, and I was talking about coming out of Imperial College. And probably the important context to understand that both Dave and I work in the Department of Bioengineering, and bioengineering is where you bring engineering solutions on people to people. So bioengineering is anything from a hearing aid to a prosthetic limb. That's what they do in bioengineering. But very specifically, at Imperial's Department of Bioengineering, we have something called the Centre for Blast Injury Studies. And that really does what it says on the tin. We study the effects of blast injury. We started by doing it in the immediate term. So as soon as people have been wounded, we started in 2010. So you can imagine, fill in the dots, you can imagine why. Now, of course, we're growing with the field, so we're studying the long-term effects. I met Save the Children, who were talking a great deal about children who'd experienced blast injury. And what they asked me was, well, I know you know a lot about what happens to adult blast injuries. What happens in children? And I went back to the boffins, and I said, what happens to children? And they said, we really don't know. We just assume it's the same as adults, but 50% less. And then I talked to some pediatric doctors, and they said, no, it's not. We have a sense of what happens, but it's much, much more complicated. The problem is nobody is studying it. Most of the patients, the child patients who experience blast injury, who have some of the very similar injuries to the people who came away from Telecan Herrick, because it's IEDs, it's unexploded munitions, it's, it's all of that. It's all the same stuff, except that they're little. They tend to pick things up rather than tread on them, and they're still growing. So we know what happens to a bone that's been blown up where the person's not growing anymore. We have no idea what happens when they're still growing. We don't do it very well in civilian life. Children who require prosthetics, particularly prosthetics on their leg, are often not given them until they stop growing because it's expensive and it's complicated. And if I don't know if you've got boys, but they tend to grow in spurts. So you can have a prosthetic limb that's been fitted and 3 months later, it's the same as a pair of shoes. Mm. They're out the prosthetic.
Well, I have a boy, two girls. I have twins, yeah. Boy, girl. So it's like my own little study.
Yes, yes.
Research. And the boy right now, you couldn't have hit that.
Yeah.
He's constantly hungry.
He's constantly hungry and growing. And you can almost hear them growing. Well, imagine if you're in a low resource environment, if you are in the conflict zone and you've lost a leg, if you can't walk, you can't go to school. If you can't go to school, you're not going to... this is... Blast injury causes illiteracy. It can cause early marriage. It can cause slavery. It causes... There are many more effects of disability, just like they understood in the Guinea Pig Club back in World War II. They're never just repairing the body.
Please explain that a little bit more. Yeah. Go into it, because I think that's... let's connect that with a human...
Yes.
We look at things like Afghanistan, where there is systematic child sex abuse with boys... And children in conflict are some of the most vulnerable people on our planet. Then we have this. You've picked up a cluster bomb that's gone off.
Yeah, and you've lost your arm.
Exactly.
Or you've had your face disfigured.
You're an orphan.
And you're an orphan.
Worst case scenario, because this is
real.
This is reality.
You've lost a limb, but you've survived, because children can survive some extraordinary... They're really... The unexpected survivors really are children. Just they can survive things that grown-ups can't. They die for different reasons, but they also survive for different reasons. And quite often they pick something up, which means that they lose a hand and they may become disfigured. They may lose an eye. But what they may also do is lose their family at the same time. So when they wake up on the operating table, in the post-operative ward, it has to be explained to them that they don't have a hand anymore, but also they don't have a mum and dad. So that injury, think of all the things that we resource really well, and we assume there's going to be family, there's going to be support, there's going to be a prosthetist, and people are going to be looked after. When you're a 10-year-old boy who finds themselves with only one leg in a place like Syria, and you're then going to be moved to a refugee camp, chances are your medical records aren't going to be transferred. The real challenges are there. The global cohort of people who are injured by blast injury are children in low-resource environments. We think three out of every five children in the world lives in a conflict zone. And
three
out of every five. It's an they live in a zone where they can potentially be injured by blast.
So whether it's the old Soviet Union,
exactly,
or these mines still laid in the ground.
Mines still laid in the, whether it's Libya, Syria, Afghanistan.
Or this active conflict going
on
right now.
Either active conflict or post conflict. So one of the things, again, I didn't know. It's been a really steep learning curve. Is that it's actually during conflict, it's about even. Children and adults get injured at about the same rate. But in a post-conflict zone, it's 50% more children, because that's when children stop hiding in their houses and they go out and they start going to school. Are they going to go to work, or they're going to play? And they go out into the rubble of the country, the place where they live, and they pick things up that they shouldn't. It's one of the biggest problems when you're reconstructing places that have been a war zone, is telling children, when you see a shiny metal object, don't pick it up.
Mm.
Because it may be an ID, it may be a UXB, it may be unexploded munitions. We don't know what it is, but if you pick it up, they tend to play in groups. The child that picks it up may be killed and the others may be very seriously injured. And suddenly, as that hospital, you're dealing with five, six, seven children who come in needing amputations or really serious surgeries. And then they go to wherever their home will be. And suddenly they can't go to work.
Mm.
And if they can't work, what does that mean for their lives? And in the case of girls, it might mean an early marriage. If they can't go to school, if they can't learn, if they're relatively young and they're unable to finish their education, they may have some basic literacy, but the prospects for them, again, early marriage, going into being abandoned by their family, unable to make their way in the place that they're now living in. People think blast injury causes physical damage. It also causes psychological damage, but it also causes damage that's going to reverberate throughout the rest of
social
damage. Yeah, yeah. When I say blast injury causes illiteracy, they say, is that because people are blinded? And it's like, no. There are some steps in between, but it's as if it is...
Mobility, financial,
everything.
So what are you doing? to help with that? And what, again, what's the Casivac?
So this is where I started. So we immediately started to put together some resources at Imperial that meant that what we already know about adult blast injury can be adapted to child blast injury. And Dave's always a part, he's part of my department. So we're working together every day. And I started to talk about this. And Save the Children said, do you think that you might have some veterans who would be interested in coming out to the refugee camps and meeting children that we're looking after who are living with the medium and long-term effects of blast injury? And I said, well, I'll ask. I know some people, I know the right people to ask. Yeah. I got that question out about half, and Dave Henson said to me, yep, when do you want us? When do you want us? So they're now putting together a trip for later on this year. It's going to be, it's the first of what I hope is many trips. And members of the Casavac Club, they're going as individuals, will go out with Save the Children. We're confirming where they'll go and how they'll get there. And they'll meet children who are living with the condition that they live with. And I hope they'll be able to pass on practical tips. I hope that they'll be really great role models for those children to say, look, this is what you can grow into. This is what you should be asking for. Don't let the organisation, the people, the community that you're living in say, OK, no leg for you. Ask for a leg. Because tell them, if you give me a leg, I can do this. I can walk. I can go to another country and explain to them about what I'm living with. And also people, they know what it's like to live with pain, to live with the psychological consequences of that kind of injury. The members of Casavac have an extraordinary amount of experience that they want to communicate. They want to communicate it to each other. They want to communicate it at home, and they want to communicate it abroad in places where it's most needed. That's the plan.
Amazing. And we forget as well. You know, we don't forget. I'll rephrase that. You know, we've looked at the World War II. We've looked at the current conflicts, yeah. and the use of cluster bombs really brings to mind,
yeah.
you know, Iraq and Afghanistan,
all of that, yeah.
First Gulf War, lots were used as well. But also the cluster bombs and butterfly bombs were first tested in or dropped in places like Grimsby,
yeah.
where kids were still prone to picking these things up.
Running over the rubble and picking them up. Nothing changes.
Nothing changes. No. We're one generation away from this happening in this country.
Exactly. Exactly. We are one generation. You know, my dad grew up in Yorkshire, and he grew up in Scarborough. And of course, Scarborough was bombed in the First World War, and there were children killed from picking the wrong things up. We really aren't very far away. And people talk about, well, you know, we must think about the kinds of bombs, and you know, we must monitor what's going on. The blast wave from an explosion doesn't know whether it's from cluster munitions or a homemade IED or a missile, an airstrike missile. The blast wave doesn't have a nationality. It doesn't have a flag. It doesn't have a tactic or a strategy.
Doesn't care if it's a child
doesn't
or
care.
A soldier.
Doesn't care.
Whatever.
Doesn't care whether it was laid or lobbed or dropped.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. So what I really want to do, and it's one of the reasons why I work in a science department now, is I want to stay focused on the wound. There are other really good people who are trying to stop people bombing in the first place. Yeah, stop bombing, by the way. Everybody put everything down and step back. That would be a good thing, but that's not my job. My job is to make sure that when these things do go off, that we don't spend a lot of time talking about the whys and wherefores. We bring the best possible knowledge that we can to the point of wounding, to saving the life, and then life beyond survival, whoever you are, wherever you are. We've got sense that we can improve that now, and we have to take that forward.
Emily, I thank you very, very, very much for coming in, and we will leave it there.